Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. It is on. Well, let me check. Let me check. It says recording, so we're in good shape. Before we get started, I just want to open in prayer. Yahweh Yeshua, Ruach HaKodesh, I just want to take this opportunity to thank you for your blessings. Thank you for your festivals and your designated times, Yahweh. And thank you for all your servants, not only here in Missouri, but all around the world that gather to celebrate your times so we can learn from our brothers and, more importantly, learn from you. Lord, I just ask that you guide my tongue and let me honor and glorify you in your name. Amen. When I volunteered for this, I was talking to Tim Kelly, and he said, for some reason, I thought I had 90 minutes. And he goes, no, you have 60. And I went, 60 minutes? He goes, well, then you got 10 minutes of Q&A at the end. He goes, so you have 50 minutes. I said, oh, great. So a lot of this is just going to be a flyby. I'm not going to drill down on any particular topic. What my whole objective is to maybe if I can give you some information, some resources to help prepare. That's what I'd like to do. A little background on me. I was originally born in northern Minnesota. My mom and dad. I didn't say anything about the Vikings, though. My mom and dad grew up during the Depression, and they taught all the kids, work. Don't be afraid to work. And that's something that has been a blessing. This is my bride right here, Jill. We got married in 1995, and she's been a blessing, huge blessing. And we are currently self-employed. We own two businesses. So I have a tendency to look at a lot of numbers, and in looking at numbers, a lot of that has led to a lot of my talk. Because when you start looking at numbers on a national level and global level, it gets to be very interesting, yeah. We call home Appleton, Wisconsin for now, and we've been there, 18 years. Yeah, she's a native. My background, I was a Catholic for a long time, and then I was 18 years old, and I disagreed with the priests and kind of went out on my own, and we've been involved in the Hebraic movement for a couple of years, and we just kept praying for the truth. Just show us the truth. Kind of like Rico says, you know, we just want the truth. My theology isn't right. I already know that. But I tell you what, we're getting closer all the time. If you notice, my name does not have any fancy initials afterwards, like CPA or PhD. I'm a business guy, I'm a servant, that's all I am. Some things that I'm going to be talking about today. A lot of the people in this group and in our groups are familiar with the Federal Reserve. I'm going to spend a few minutes on that, some of the history. I'm going to talk about cartels, a little bit on fractional reserve banking, world reserve currency, the Clord-Piven strategy. When I heard about that, it really was an eye-opener for me. The petrodollar system, touch base a little bit on inflation, consumer price index, unemployment, Social Security. And we've all heard my people perish for lack of knowledge. And like I said before, I want to give as much information as I can. Maybe you guys know a lot of this, great. If I can give you one grain of sand, that's something you can walk away with. You've given me your time. You've given me an hour of your time. So I need to feel that I have to give you something that's reasonable to listen to. I like to quote different people, and there's one particular quote I have here. It's, the biggest barrier to truth is that we already have it. Yeah. So if you think you got it all, then we're unteachable. So when I first heard that years ago, I went, boy, I'd like that. Just some definitions real quick. Understanding is knowing things in the right relationship. When you know things in the right relationship, you have understanding. Wisdom, knowledge guided by understanding. Discernment, to discern between good and evil. Instruction is imparting knowledge to others. And we, in our movement, we need to impart knowledge, to instruct others who aren't here yet. Because we all have our own story on how we got here. You know, David and I were talking last night. We're both 2 years into this. And there's other people. I'll use Dean Wheelock, being from Wisconsin. He's been doing this, 30 years? So we just need to draw people in. Learning, the modification of behavior. We're all here to learn. If you make a mistake and it costs you $1,000, hopefully you don't make that mistake again. When you do, your behavior changes. Truth, that which agrees with final reality. That's kind of sobering thought. There is one final reality, and it's on Judgment Day. When Yahweh entered Jerusalem, he wept, and he held his people accountable to know the time and to know the scriptures. And that's why he wept, because he was presenting himself as king. And if he held his own people accountable, do you think he's going to hold us accountable to know the scriptures? I think he is. And how many times has he told us, do not be deceived? And in the world that we're living in, deceit is running rampant. Ecclesiastes 1:9, that which has been is what will be, that which is done is what will be done. There's nothing new under the sun. And being new to this movement, when I realized that I was taught in Greek thinking, which is linear, and when I found out that God made everything in cycles, that was like someone turning all these lights on in my head at one time. It was like, I never knew that. I've been taught this other way to think. And Hitler made a quote, if you give me the books and I'll control the generations. So, another quote from Brad Scott. If you are doing what you are doing what you believe, if you say you believe something and you're doing something different, then that's not really what you believe. So, I like to listen to him too. I believe the beginning, how this was created, and I believe the end. And it's just even listening to Rico the last couple days, you know, it's been awesome. Just awesome. So there's a... just because yesterday was good and today is good doesn't mean tomorrow is going to be good. They have a term for that. It's called normalcy bias. And a good example is, think of September 10th, 2001. That was a good day. September 11th? That wasn't. Or an example I found in 1935, there were 100,000 Jews that had already left Germany, but there were over 450,000 that remained, and they thought, you know what, the worst is behind us. We're going to be okay. We can get through this. Of those 450,000 that remained, there wasn't a lot that made it out. So, and I just say that, I don't want this to be fearful. I want this, Yahweh's our provider. It's that simple. The priests, when Israel entered the promised land, the priests had to get into the water of the Jordan first. So hopefully that's what I want to do. I just want to throw some seeds out there. Hopefully something takes grab and we can do that. Okay, I'm going to jump right in. This is the information I have to go through. I don't think I'm going to make all of it. So, cartels. Anybody have an idea what a cartel is? I mean, we hear about it in the news a little bit. Right after World War I, there was a cartel in Germany known as IG Farben. And what a cartel is it's a community of interests or a community of a group. They look out for each other. When the group first came together, they were a lot of chemical companies. And they made dye stocks. And just a simple definition of a cartel is an international monopoly. That's the easiest way to think about it. It's a group of international corporations with corporate interests that come together by a contract and agree not to compete in various areas where they might otherwise compete. A good example is instead of saying, they'll say, you know what, you take North America, we'll take South America. You work on, we're going to manufacture antiseptics and you manufacture these other drugs. They agree not to compete on products, and that way they don't cross over their paths. And what they end up doing is they layer these agreements one on top of another. So pretty soon, as time goes on, instead of all these separate companies, they're all married together. And they're all working together, not to protect our interests, but to protect their interests. The cartels, IG Farben, exists in 93 countries and all the continents, and they were first really discovered at the end of World War II when the Allied forces came into Germany. There was a group of buildings where their headquarters were, and there was a lot of information that was destroyed, but there was still a lot of records that were there. And it's all a matter of record. A lot of it came out in the Nuremberg trials. And just I'll just read a couple of the companies that had interlocking agreements with IG Farben. There's over 2,000 companies. They dominated all of German industry. And a lot of Europe, and they had a big grasp or big grip in the United States. And some of the companies were Dow Chemical Company, DuPont, Eastman Kodak, Firestone Rubber, Ford Motor, General Electric, General Mills, General Motor, Glidden Paint, Goodyear Rubber, Kellogg Company, Monsanto Chemical, Gulf Oil, Nestle, Procter & Gamble, Remington Arms, Shell Oil, Standard Oil, Texaco, and the Bayer Company, which is Bayer Aspirin. Professor Bayer was one of the founders of IG Farben. The whole one way this got started was after World War I, the people of IG Farben said, hey, you know what? Germany, we basically lost World War I because we ran out of fuel. We ran out of gas. We don't have diesel or gas. So what they did is they set their top chemists to work to figure out a way to make fuel from something they had a lot of in Germany. And that was coal. And they came up with a process called Fischer-Tropsch process, which is they can make fuel through this. And what they did is then they invited Shell Oil over to Germany to show them their process, to basically say, hey, you know, we have all the fuel we want, and we don't need your fuel. So that's how the cartel agreements came about. They were basically showing them their cards so they knew what was what. I'm going to tie back into cartels here in a minute. The Federal Reserve, I'm just going to kind of zip through this too. That was on Jekyll Island. As a matter of fact, I have, as you can see, different resources, and I guess most of the people in this room are familiar with The Creature from Jekyll Island. I also have it on audio CD up here somewhere. So these things are free to take. The books, please leave. But I drive a lot, so I like to listen to things on audio CD. When things are done in secret, they do it for a reason. They're hiding something, and we can see what they've done now. Seven men who were at this meeting on Jekyll Island was Senator Nelson Ulrich, who was a very, very powerful man. I'm not going to go into their backgrounds. Abraham Andrew, who was Assistant Secretary to the Treasury, Frank Vanderloop, who was the President of National Bank and Trust in New York, Henry Davidson, who was a senior member of J.P. Morgan, Charles Norton, who was a president of First National Bank in New York, Benjamin Strong, who was the head of J.P. Morgan, and Paul Warburg, who was very knowledgeable on banking and central banks. And the people at that time, they knew that over in Europe they had these central banks, and they didn't want that. So anytime something like that came up, it always got voted down. So the whole idea behind the Federal Reserve is it's a central bank, but they just had to paint it up and make it look like it wasn't. These seven men that I just mentioned briefly, directly and indirectly, they represented 25% of the wealth of the world at that time. Yeah, that's a lot. And just a little quick side note for J.P. Morgan. Upon his death, they realized that he only owned 19% of what everyone thought he owned. He was basically a front man for the Rothschild family. And the Rothschilds, that's a whole other study in itself. So basically what these men did is they formed a banking cartel. So they were looking out for everybody's interests. And a quote from John D. Rockefeller, competition is a sin. Yeah. What big business would do is if there was competition, they'd go try to buy them out. If they couldn't buy them out, well, let's make a cartel agreement with them. Because in the early 1900s, it was known as the era of the cartel agreement in the United States. Industries were all, instead of fighting each other for profits, they were joining each other together. And that was, well, close to 100 years ago. And they found that it worked very well for them, and they liked it. The Federal Reserve System, again, is nothing more than a banking cartel. And because it was passed by the government, they entered into a partnership with that. And any time you enter into a partnership, it has to be a win-win situation. So what does the government get out of it? The government gets basically as much money as they want. Because if the government goes to the people, hey, we need another $1 billion, we're going to say, what do you need it for? Well, what did you do with the last $1 billion we gave you? You know? So the government, without going into great detail, they get as much money as they want. So what does the banking cartel get? They get fractional reserve banking, which, to summarize it, a bank, if they have $1 million in cash in their bank, they can loan up to $9 million out. And they get interest on nothing. It's like if I ask Chris, I say, Chris, can I borrow $1,000? Sure, I'll give you $1,000 if he was the bank. Well, then when I pay him back, then I pay him back interest that he has nothing to do with. And it's pure profit. And the banking cartel has the government to enforce all the rules. So those two guys, I shouldn't say guys, the corporations are loving it because it's a win-win. It's a win-win situation for them. I'm cruising through this kind of fast because, like I said, I have a lot of things to cover. Fractional reserve banking I just went over. Inflation. A good analogy of inflation is a pot of soup. My bride makes excellent soup, chicken soup. Oh, it's really good. But the more water you add to it, you lose your taste. It's watered down. It's not as good. And what inflation does is it appears that things are costing more, but they're not. It's taking more dollars to buy them. 1970, what you paid 11 cents for now takes a dollar to buy. 1970, that's what, 41 years ago. That's not that long ago. I mean, I'm looking around and I think we were all there. We were all buying stuff at that time. If you look back in history, say 2,000 years ago, if you had an ounce of gold and you wanted to go buy a nice robe, you get a nice robe, some sandals, a belt, a tunic, for an ounce of gold. Now, if you take an ounce of gold, which is roughly $1,600, you can go out and get a nice suit, a nice pair of wingtip shoes, a top hat. You still get a nice set of clothes for an ounce of gold. The value of the gold hasn't changed. It's the fiat money that we use has changed. To touch base back on fractional banking, sometimes people say, well, when inflation starts, it's a good time to borrow money because you're going to be paying your loan back with inflated dollars. So you're thinking, well, I'm paying back less. But if you do that, you have to be careful. Read your loan papers very well because there's something they call a floating index. And if you're in your loan papers, if it says there's a floating index in there, if official inflation is 15%, that index is tied to that. So you're going to be paying back 15% more above and beyond. So that's just a little nugget I want to throw out there. Floating index. Talked on that. To get the bill passed for the Federal Reserve, they did it with trickery and deceit. Mr. Ulrich and Mr. Vanderloop, who were two of the seven guys, came out and started giving big press conferences saying, we can't pass this because if we pass it, it's bad for the banking industry. So the American people think, if it's bad for the banking industry, it must be good for us. So it's kind of the old bait and switch thing. And something else that this group of seven men did is they got a Department of Economics in various colleges throughout the United States. They gave them large financial contributions to go out and to teach how bad this bill was and to start a grassroots movement on how bad this bill was. And they ended up taking a final vote on it on December 22nd, December 23rd, when a lot of the congressmen and senators were heading back for Christmas break. So it passed, and Paul Warburg made an interesting comment. There was one man who was fighting him tooth and nail on this whole thing. And so Paul Warburg added a comment that said that they will not be allowed to print money. So his big opponent said, okay, if you're not printing money, I'm for it. So he said, okay, I sign on with this now. And then all the other guys were telling him, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? It's not going to work. And Paul Warburg's comment was, don't worry about it. We'll fix it after it's passed. Since it's been passed, it's been changed over 100 times. So it goes right back to, let's not be deceived. Yeshua told us, do not be deceived. The name of the game is power. Power and control. And that's what they're after. That's what they're really after. So that's just a quick rundown on that. Has anyone ever heard of the Cloward-Piven strategy? Okay. Cloward-Piven strategy. I'm going to read this because I'm afraid I'm going to butcher it. It's just one page here. On May 2nd, 1966, two Columbia University sociologists. Thank you. Professor of Social Work Richard A. Cloward and his then research assistant Francis Piven wrote a pivotal article in The Nation. Articulating a strategy to end poverty. In what was known as the Cloward-Piven strategy, this article argued a revolutionary approach to mobilizing the poor in a form of class warfare against capitalist forces viewed as exploiting labor and oppressing the poor. David Horowitz, a longtime student of leftist Political movements in the United States characterize the Cloward-Piven strategy as seeking to hasten the fall of capitalism by overloading the government bureaucracy with a flood of impossible demands, thus pushing society into crisis and economic collapse. Cloward and Piven argued a guaranteed annual income should be established as an entitlement for the poor, a right the poor could assert and demand to be paid. Arguing for massive registration of poor in existing social welfare programs, Cloward and Piven sought to create a crisis that could be exploited to obtain a fundamental redistribution of power in favor of the have-nots. Advancing their social reform aim, Cloward and Piven explained the crisis they sought can occur spontaneously, i.e. riots, I don't know if there's any of those going on now, or as intended results of tactics of demonstrations and protest, which either generate disruption or bring unrecognized disruption to the public attention. The Cloward-Piven strategy sought to apply the tactics of revolutionary civil rights movements, including urban riots, to the poor as a whole, transcending interest group politics defended by race to involve interest groups defined by class. Racial black activist George Wiley created the National Welfare Reform Organization to implement the Cloward-Piven strategy. Stern, writing in the City Journal, noted that the foot soldiers hired by the National Welfare Reform Organization were successful in expanding the welfare rolls from 4.3 million to 10.8 million by the mid-1970s, with the result in New York City, where the strategy had been particularly successful. One person was on the welfare roll in New York City for every two working people in the private economy. James Simpson, a former White House staff economist and budget analyst, wrote in the American Thinker, "Vast expansion of welfare in New York City that came from the National Welfare Reform Organization, Cloward-Piven tactics, sent the city of New York into bankruptcy in 1975. I was young when it happened, but I remember talking about a bailout of New York City. I had no idea what it was. Has anyone seen Rules for Radicals, Sal Alinsky? Rules for Radicals by Sal Alinsky? It's the same thing as the Cloward-Piven strategy. And this group, I know, we all know we have to be careful what we're being fed by the media. And with these things going on in New York, when the riots started in Greece, I was telling friends, I said, you know, these riots come into a street near us soon. And what did it take? It took less than a year to get to the States. Are they spontaneous? Don't think so. Libya, a quick note on Libya. He started selling oil not in U.S. dollars, but in euros. And if these rebels in Libya were so concerned, why did they set up a central bank before they started the riots? Rioters don't do that. Okay, I'm getting ahead of myself. Can't do that. Sorry. I'm going to skip that. A quote by Alexander Tyler. He was a Scottish historian at the University of Edinburgh. He was talking about the Athens Republic 2,000 years prior. A democracy is always temporary in nature. It simply cannot exist as a permanent form of government. A democracy will continue to exist until the time that the voters discover that they can vote themselves generous gifts from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidate who promises the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that every democracy will finally collapse over loose financial policy, which is always followed by a dictatorship. The average age of the world's greatest civilization from the beginning of history is about 200 years. During those 200 years, the nations always go through this process, from bondage to spiritual faith. Just think of the United States history. From bondage to spiritual faith. From spiritual faith to great courage. From courage to liberty. From liberty to abundance. From abundance to complacency. From complacency to apathy. From apathy to dependency. From dependency back to bondage. So in your own minds, just think, where are we at right now? 47% of the people in America are getting some type of funds from the federal government. 47%. So as soon as we cross over that threshold of 50%, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. And this is an excellent example of my God, my Creator, working in cycles. Do we, as Americans, think we're above all this? Do we think we're above persecution? Nah, I don't think so. Okay, I'm going to jump into the petrodollar system. Has anyone ever heard of that? Okay, all right, good. Well, there's a couple here. I have about a 9-minute audio CD that I'm going to play because this man, his name is Jerry Robinson, and he has a weekly download from the internet. It's called Follow the Money. He's a born-again believer. He's a Christian. I've spoken with him a number of times on the phone in private conversations before he started this. He's been on the internet for roughly a year and a half. And his tagline is, if you want to know the truth about what's going on in the economy, follow the money. And when I first heard this petrodollar system, I went, I never thought of that. I never knew it. And it goes back and it ties in the Federal Reserve and the monetary system. So let's give it a go here. Hopefully,
I believe that the U.S. dollar is going to experience a slow and painful death.
Is it okay?
Many have disagreed with me and have said that the dollar was going to collapse fast and quick. Many people called for this back in 2008 amid the financial crisis. Then they said the dollar would collapse in 2009. Then they were certain that the U.S. dollar would implode completely in 2010. Now, I'm sure that there are going to be a flurry of financial reports being promoted and marketed telling you why the dollar will collapse in 2011. And I'm here today to tell you that I agree that the U.S. dollar is going to collapse. But the difference is, with me, has always been a question of when. When do I think the U.S. dollar will completely collapse? I'll tell you in just a moment. You know, it's funny when I think about it. 3 or 4 years ago, when I was warning Christians and secular America alike on the reality of the coming economic crisis. During that time, I remember speaking to audiences with glazed eyes. I couldn't get anyone to fully believe that a collapse of the U.S. dollar was going to happen in the future. Now, however, so many experts have appeared after the fact with tales of doom and gloom and dates and predictions. And many of the same people that I couldn't convince to prepare just a few short years ago now believe that the U.S. dollar will collapse before tomorrow morning. Friends, listen to me. Today, I want to share with you the one event that you need to watch for that will trigger the real collapse of the U.S. dollar. When this event that I'm going to share with you right now does finally happen, nothing, and I mean nothing, will prevent the dollar from hyperinflating. The first step to understanding how the dollar will collapse is to understand something known as the petrodollar system. Now, I know that not all of you are history buffs, so I promise to make this simple and painless as possible. Sit back for a minute, and I'll explain. In the mid-1970s, a deal was struck between the oil-producing nations of OPEC and the U.S., and then later with other nations. Now, according to this agreement, every barrel of oil purchased in the global marketplace by anyone must be purchased with U.S. dollars. So according to this new oil deal, any country around the world that desired to purchase a barrel of oil had to first exchange their national currency for U.S. dollars. This new oil deal became known as the petrodollar system. Today, with few exceptions, all oil transactions are made in U.S. dollars. This means that if you want to buy a barrel of oil anywhere in this world, you must pay for it with U.S. dollars. Now, there are a few exceptions, and I'll tell you about those in a moment. If you do not have U.S. dollars, you must obtain them somehow. One way for a foreign country to get U.S. dollars is simply to convert their currency for dollars on the open exchange.
That, of course, involves a fee. A more complicated but advantageous way is to design a product and export it to the U.S. in exchange for your goods, and you get U.S. dollars. If you're a small business owner in Japan, you must first convert your yen into dollars to purchase oil. Mexico must convert its pesos to dollars to buy oil, and so on. Perhaps this will help you understand why so many Asian nations since the 1980s have depended upon an export-led strategy to grow their economies. Japan, for example, has very few natural resources, including oil. So they must import large amounts of oil, and of course this means that they must have lots of U.S. dollars.
So Japan manufactures a Honda and ships it to the U.S. and immediately receives payment in U.S. dollars, which it uses to purchase oil. As you can imagine, this petrodollar system has proven very beneficial to the United States economy.
Oh, and there's one more other benefit that I haven't told you about. Many of the oil-producing nations not only agreed to sell their oil in exchange for U.S. dollars instead of their own currency, but they also agreed to then take their excess profits and then invest them back into the safety of U.S. government bonds. So in essence, America receives a double loan out of every single global oil transaction. First, it increases global demand for U.S. dollars, and second, for U.S. debt securities. But wait, there's more, as they say on the infomercial late night. In addition, having oil priced in dollars means that the U.S. can print money to buy oil. Let me say this again. The U.S. can print money to buy oil and then have the oil producers hold the debt that was created by printing the money in the first place. What other nation on earth, my friends, besides America, can print money to buy something and then have those who sold it to them hold the debt for the printed money? As you can well imagine, Washington is thrilled with this arrangement and has been so for decades. The rest of the world, however, is not so excited about this system. Today, several countries are beginning to move their oil sales or purchases into other currencies in spite of the dollar. Just a handful of examples include Iran, Syria, North Korea, and Venezuela. By the way, that happens to be the old Bush axis of evil. You know, friends, what is happening in our world today makes a whole lot of sense if you simply learn to read between the lines. But that means that you have to ignore the quote-unquote official reasons that are constantly crammed down your throat by the mainstream media. When Iraq tried to move its oil sales away from the dollar and into euros in 2002, it felt the full force of the U.S. military bearing down on it. Within days of the U.S. entering Baghdad, the petrodollar system was put back into place. Did you hear about that story on the evening news? Now, here's what I want you to see. When, not if, the petrodollar system begins to crumble, the dollar will begin its death spiral. Right now, America has a permission slip to print all the dollars that it wants to print. Why? Because the world needs dollars to buy oil. It's that simple. So the Fed just prints away, knowing that the global demand for U.S. dollars and for U.S. debt should remain strong enough to prevent hyperinflation. However, when OPEC and the other major global oil players decide to pull the plug and finally denominate their oil sales in another currency other than the dollar, the artificial demand for the dollar will decrease. The U.S. will be stuck holding a lot of worthless paper dollars that no one needs anymore, which will ultimately lead to massive inflationary pressures on the U.S. economy. Don't think that this will happen. Foreign governments are acutely aware of America's economic problems. Knowing this, many of them are biding their time by actively looking for alternatives to the U.S. dollar-denominated assets for investment purposes. In the months and years ahead, other global currencies will be strong competitors for these same global investment dollars. When the petrodollar system collapses, it will lead to astronomical interest rates and the end of the U.S. dollar. So with all of that in context, consider this week's report by the New York Times about China and Russia moving away from the dollar.
This is about a year old.
According to the report, the two countries opened direct trading between the Chinese yuan currency and the Russian ruble. thus allowing them to completely avoid the U.S. dollar in their bilateral trade. Among their imports and exports that will avoid the use of dollars, oil. Friends, Russia and China are pioneering a move away from the U.S. dollar. The collapse of the dollar is coming, but it's not here yet. So now to answer my earlier question on when the dollar will collapse. The dollar will completely collapse when the petrodollar system collapses. When will that happen? No one knows for sure, but based upon our understanding, we believe that it will begin breaking down around 2012 or shortly thereafter. We have been monitoring the petrodollar system for many years and will continue reporting to you as we see further warning signs. Friends, it's because we bring you the truth and avoid the hype that you should listen to this program each week and share it with your friends and your family.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the streets, and nobody anywhere seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe. Our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living room. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel belted radio, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to ride. I don't want you to write to your congressman, because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crying in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. My life has value.
I thought I'd put that on there on the end. Okay, the gentleman again who spoke, his name is Jerry Robinson. It's free. And it's called Follow the Money Weekly. He has a Follow the Money Daily, which he'll send you an email on some market stuff. I'm sorry? Jerry Robinson. But if you Google Follow the Money, then he has Follow the Money Weekly, which is the radio. It's 60 minutes. And it's a free download. And he has a gentleman that talks about precious metals. And his name is Tom Cloud. He's a born-again believer in Jesus Christ, not Yeshua. But he's been been selling metals for over 30 years. And actually, now that we're on that part of the topic, I have a couple handouts here. And I'm not saying gold and silver. I'm not saying to buy it. I'm saying if you're interested, here's some information. And if you decide to purchase metals, this will tell you things that I wish I knew before I had this information. And I only have like 5 or 6 copies here, but if we need more, I can talk to Ann, and Ann, we can make more copies. So just kind of keep me posted. And then...
Oh!
Okay. We'll deal with that. I'll go get some. And then here's some on gold. But the... When I first heard that, all of a sudden I went, boy, there's so much of that that makes sense now. Libya, he started selling oil in euros. And what did the United States do? They trumped up some riots. Then they trumped up some other, I won't say it, reason to go in to get the country and to work on it. And they're working on that. I'm going to jump around a little bit here. I like visual things. I'm a kind of guy that says, show me. And I'm not from Missouri, if you remember. This is a three-legged stool. And if this is society, society is supported by three legs. I will put it up on the table, but let me demonstrate first. There's three legs. Oh, politics. Economics and religion. And when these legs are all doing what they're doing, society is supported. But when one leg gets out of whack for whatever reason, you usually have troubles. what does that mean to you? That's what I want you to think about. What would happen if one of the three legs fell? What's that? Yeah. But what does that mean to you and your family? I don't know. I don't know what the future. I don't know what the future holds. I know what the Word of God says, and I know in the Hebraic thought how everything is cyclical. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm just wondering. Oh, I broke my thing here. And then back to follow the money. The gentleman, he also has a retirement specialist on there, and he only talks for 1 or 2 minutes on retirement. And when you get closer to retirement, there are three different avenues of income. Yeah, I'll put this back up here. I can all see a little better. One is self-investments. Anything that you've made to invest in, rental property, whatever. Anything that doesn't have to do with the government. Then you might say, well, you know, I was working for this company and I have a 401k and an IRA and all this. Okay, great, good. And then the third one is Social Security. I think everyone in this room knows what's going to happen with Social Security. 401k, there is roughly $14 to $15 trillion in funds for 401ks and retirement plans. Now think, if you were in a power of position, a position of power, and you're having financial problems, but you look over there and you say, huh, there's $14 trillion over there. How can I get my hands on that? I like to study things. I like to learn. And a lot of the people that I listen to, they've been throwing up red flags for about 18 months, 24 months now. Don't know. Take a look at your own 401ks, you know, see what's what. But here again, if you have retirement and you have three legs of income coming in, and all of a sudden the Social Security system goes belly up, what does that mean to you? Yeah, but my mom, she's 80, 81 years old, and she gets, what, $400 a month or something like that? What happens if that $400 is now gone? How are you going to pay your electric? How are you going to buy food? How are you going to live? I don't know what's going to happen. Here again, knock this thing out, it falls over. And this back to this Jerry Robinson, he has a program that he's coming out with, and it's something that's not for sale. It's free. It's free, different income streams. What to do to have different income streams. So if something happens in the future, at least you have something. You can survive. You can pay your bills. You can buy food. Whatever. I digress a little bit. I'm sorry. There's another gentleman that I like to listen to. He's a born-again believer. And his name is John Loeffler. And his name of his organization is called Steel on Steel. As iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. He calls himself an early warning system. He's been on the internet for 20 years. He's been doing this for 20 years, but obviously with the internet, he's growing more popular. And the first time I listened to it, his tagline says, "Your failure to be informed doesn't make me a wacko." as soon as I heard that, I went, okay, you got my attention. He's not free. I think you can get a subscription to him for, if he downloads it to you, it's like $4 a month. It's like $1 a download. Because he has expenses. He's got to pay for the lights and all the other stuff. But he's more on the philosophical side, but he's very good. Steel on Steel. If you Google it, that'll be that. Oh, my goodness. Let me just fly through some of this other stuff. We've got to go to Q&A here in just a couple minutes. A good definition of a trillion. I saw this and I went, I need that. If I borrowed, Mark, some money from you and I said, let me pay you back in 1 million seconds. You'd say, okay, just a minute. Get your calculator out. That's 12 days. Yeah, I'll loan you some money, Kelly. That's no problem. But then I said, oh, you know what? Did I say 1 million? I meant to say 1 billion seconds. And you go, well, let me rethink this. Let me do it again. Well, 1 billion seconds is 32 years. And I said, oh, did I say 1 billion? I meant to say 1 trillion seconds. 1 trillion seconds is 32,000 years. So, when our federal government owes, the 14 point whatever trillion, and that's not counting Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, with unfunded liabilities, that's up to 75 or $100 trillion. I mean, just think about it. Do you really think we can pay that back? Okay, so what does that mean to you and your family? As men of your households, you are the priests of your households. You need to prepare. That's part of our responsibility. And I take that very serious, and my bride and I get some interesting discussions sometimes. let's see here. Okay. I just got to throw out a couple loose things real quick. Something that I just found 3 weeks ago, the SATs that kids take before they go into college were the lowest on record. And they started keeping track of the SATs in 1926. So, if there is an agenda to dumb down the kids, that's what it looks like. I just look at numbers. Let's see here. Unemployment. Do you guys know the difference between U3 and U6? Okay. U6 is what is on NBC, CNBC. Unemployment is 9.1%. Well, Mr. Clinton, when he was in office, unemployment started climbing, and he's going, I got to get reelected. How am I going to do this? Well, you know what? Maybe if I change the definition, because remember I did some definitions at the beginning of the talk? So, if someone's on unemployment for more than a year, then they're taken off the unemployment figures and they're put on the U3. So, they're not counted as unemployed anymore, even though they're still getting money. So, if you take the U3 and the U6 and add those together, you can go from 19 to 22% unemployment. Yeah. The Great Depression, it was about 20-22%. So that's that. Does the U3? Yeah. I don't think so. Yeah. Because they just fall right off the rolls. They just fly under the radar. I would have a tendency to agree with you. And, it's in here somewhere. We've closed down how many, where is it? I don't know, I had a statistic of how many factories have actually been closed in the last 10 years. 43,000. Yeah, 43,000. And how many manufacturing jobs have been lost? Millions and millions of jobs, manufacturing jobs, which is the backbone for an economy. They're gone. They're not coming back. Okay, time's running really quick. I gotta throw this in. Our current administration believes they want a green electricity. Right now, of all our energy, 42% of our energy comes from coal. 42% comes from coal. 34% comes from natural gas, 15% from nuclear, 7% from hydro, and 2% from wind and solar. Okay, remember that. 2% from wind and solar. The stated goal of our current administration is 70% of our energy coming from renewable sources within 10 years. So can we go from 9% to 70% in 10 years? Can't do it. It's impossible. Oh, SIGTARP. Oh, there's so much information I want to share. I have, you know what? I have some audio CDs up here. The one we listened to, the petrodollar system, I have that here. I have the audio version on gold and how to buy gold and silver if you're interested. Has anyone ever heard of the abiotic theory of oil? Yes. To summarize it really quick, because I have a 10-minute audio CD here, oil is a renewable source. From the center of the earth with the hydrocarbons and everything, this gets really into a real technical, how it regenerates. So, if oil's a renewable source, why are we fighting over oil? Oh, gee, we were taught how to think in a Greek term. There's our problem. Yep. And it's the same thing as evolution. He was talking about peak oil. We're going to run out of oil in 1979. That was the big prediction.
And it was all in our, when I went to school, that's what they told you.
Yep.
And we had this thing called the weekly reader.
Yep. Yep.
Oh, we're going to run out of oil.
Yep. But I have some audio CDs. This is just a little 10-minute thing on the theory of abiotic oil. And it's the same thing when I heard that petrodollar system and this, and I'm going, we are being deceived. It's that simple. So, let's see, what else here? Huh? Yep.
Nine is the number for judgment for
there now. Oh, excellent. Yep, excellent. You're right. Here's this is a DVD from the John Birch Society. It goes into real basic economics. It's very good. It's about 45 minutes. I have some extra copies. Help yourself. Let's see, what else do I have here? If anyone is interested in, the follow the money thing, you guys can get on your own. If anyone is interested on steel on steel, because there is a cost to it, if you want to get a couple audio CDs for free, one of the gals in my office, she said she'd be more than glad to send you a couple of them just to listen to them. She works for me. So if you're interested in that, just sign up. You know, I'll send you a couple, 2 weeks. You can listen to it if you like it. Then subscribe, but, you know. I've given them to Chris for what, a year, year and a half. It's good information. It's good information. I suppose I got to go to Q&A because we only got a couple minutes left. Yes, ma'am. Well, I ran out of time, and that's what I. There's so much information. I was keeping information. I had this much stuff to sort through, and I couldn't do it. Basically, 23 is our campsite. Oh, that was for a different reason, though. And basically, this follow the money man, Jerry Robinson, he came up with 5 steps to financial freedom. And when I heard that, I thought, oh, this is going to be one of those cheesy things. Tell you what, it's really practical. The first words out of his mouth is, you make a giving plan to God. It's not your money anyway. It's not our money. You give to God because it's a test. It's a test. So I have that answer for you, ma'am. It's a 27-minute CD. There you go. Would you like one too? I got a stack like this, and if we run out, I'm sure Ann can help me duplicate some more.
Yeah, and the old
There you go, there you go.
Do you have a website where this stuff can be downloaded from? That would be the easiest way to...
Yes, follow the money.
So this stuff's all on follow.
Well, for the five steps to financial freedom, it's follow the money. And the first step is basic... make sure you have enough food and water for 3 months in case there's an emergency, and have some real basic things. And then the second step is asset protection. Make sure you have the right insurances for your car and your house and everything else. Then the third step is now increase so you have enough food for 6 months and, you know, enough money in case something happens. And then step four is the... I'm going from memory, bear with me. Then if you want to start making some investments. And that's why I'm a little leery to say this gold and silver stuff over here. I have no idea where you guys are at. But if you're at that point and you want to do that, great. And I need to add this real quick. Silver was trading at actually went over $50 an ounce probably 8-10 weeks ago. And now it's trading around $33 an ounce. Thank you very much. And the guys that I've purchased from, and on Follow the Money, the guy that he sells gold and silver, he talks about what's going on. They change the reserve requirements. A lot of the people buy metals on a margin. So let's say you have $100, but you buy $1,000 worth of metal. That 90% is margin. They in 10 days... they change the margin requirements on silver 3 times. It's kind of like you buying a house, you have to have 20% down. Boom, okay. You're a month into it, they say, Mr. Russo, we really appreciate your loan. We had the banking change, and we already know you gave us 20%, but we need another 10%. Okay, I scramble, I find 10% more. A month later, they knock on my door again, say, Mr. Russo, we really appreciate this. We had some more changes, we need another 15%. What that does, they've done that with silver 4 times that I'm aware of, and gold 2 or 3 times. Yep, it forces people to sell, and that's what's driving the money down, or the price down. So I'm in it for the long haul. I look at it, I go, I don't care, whatever happens, happens. Because I know a couple years from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, I would love to buy silver at $33 an ounce. But that's my opinion. Yes, sir.
I realize you can't eat ferns, you can't eat silver, so take your ferns, silver, eat some of it, and if you're a water supply.
Yes, sir.
That's your first need.
Yep.
Then 6 months or two, whatever you feel, the capability of growing yourself and protecting.
Yep.
Within reason what you can give it stewardship over.
Yep. I could only. I'm over my time, and I'm going to get hollered at. The next group starts in 10 minutes. I do have to read this though. We can talk afterwards. In Daniel chapter 2, when he gave the interpretation of the dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. And then. Philippians chapter 4. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your mind in Yeshua. Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, whatever is excellent, if there is any praise in these, think about these things. What you have learned and received and heard and seen in Yeshua, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. I gotta stop. I'm in trouble. Thank you for your time.